Welcome back to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host today, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining us for the second day of our coverage of the penultimate episode of Season 11, and possibly the entire series, which is Nothing Lasts Forever. And Darren Mooney's back with me. Hi, Darren.
Hey, Carl. How are things?
Things are good, thanks. And yeah, today we're going to talk all about Barbara Beaumont and her cult and some of the other characters that turned up in this fascinating episode. But before we do, I mean, this was a very grisly episode, wasn't it? And I've seen, like, split opinion on from fans about that. I mean, what were your thoughts on, like, the gore quotient in this episode?
Well, I mean, tomorrow we're probably going to talk a bit about James Wong as a director, but it feels very much like a James Wong episode in terms of, like, Founder's Mutation had a similar thing last year with the blood in the eyes and stuff. And I mean, even stuff like Wong's direction of Final Destination, which is very much like a how do you treat a human body as a pincushion philosophy, or even his work as a writer and also director on, say, American Horror Story, which has a very similar vibe as well. Like, it felt... I don't mind the occasional Grindhouse X-Files episode. Like, I don't mind, for example, Home would be one example. Now, I don't think this is as bad or as intense as Home. It does have a similar sort of, like, black comic undertone to the grotesquerie, which I think works quite well. But, I mean, even stuff like, you know, in the second season, you would have stuff like F Emasculata, for example, which was very body horror-esque. Or Sanguinarium, which is another episode in the fourth season that I know the entire writing staff worked on, but I believe Morgan and Wong may have had a stronger influence on than many of the other writers who were also trying to fix it. And you can see that with the level of gore and sort of 70s or 80s horror bleeding through it. And I think, like, the level of violence and gore in the episode is very much intended to create a sense of this sort of, like, 70s schlocky horror. Mulder likens it to a Hammer horror film when he's talking about, like, a vampire stake through the heart. And I feel like that's a very important part of the episode's aesthetic, and it's particularly important when you get to, obviously, who we're talking about today, among other people, Barbara Beaumont.
It is indeed, and I mean, personally, I'm not that sensitive to blood and guts and stuff, so I was mildly surprised then when I logged online after watching the episode, and there were people saying they hadn't eaten since the episode aired, and that kind of thing, but I do understand it, I think, and I mean, it started right away in the teaser, didn't it?
With the licking, but... What really got me was, and it isn't so much the blood or the gore or like the smoothies or whatever, anything like that. The bit that really got me was there's a really quick shot of Levinas after he, you know, when he's confronting Mulder. And it's an insert shot of, and I know it's a prosthetic on an actor's back, but it's the stitches between the back and they stretch. And it's just, that's like my nightmare of going to the doctor's office. It's like, ugh. That was the bit more than any of like the consuming of organs or the gutting of your man or the carving up of one of the followers like a Christmas turkey. It's that quick insert of like a stitches on a prosthetic that really made me go just a little bit.
I mean, what about this sequence then? I'll tell you one thing quickly before we move on is, did you hear Tad O'Malley talking about chemtrails coming from the car radio? That was an interesting touch, I thought.
It was indeed. Tad O'Malley, like a nice little bit of sort of dovetailing, like Tad O'Malley really pushing the whole chemtrails thing. You got to admit, the guy has a brand and he sort of sticks to it. I do like it though. It is a nice example of like world building and continuity and this sort of like... And I think it's something that happens a lot, and interestingly enough, in James Wong episodes, like in Founder's Mutation and in Ghoulie, is this sort of like subtle bending of like the long-standing Chinese wall that has existed between mythology and standalones. And I mean, this is obviously, this is nothing like Founder's Mutation, which is basically like, I think Chris Knowles has argued that Founder's Mutation is basically, what if all the mutants in the X-Files are actually tied to the conspiracy? Which is an interesting read of the episode. But he's also, like, even stuff like Ghoulie, which starts out as a monster of the week, and then it's like, oh, by the way, William, this isn't as intense, but the Tad O'Malley cameo is a nice little sort of dovetail heading into the finale. And it reminds me a bit of, like, last year, Babylon, for example, had the trumpet of Mulder hearing the trumpet of God's judgment heading into My Struggle 2. And it's a nice subtle nod, which I quite liked.
Yeah, and before we get to Barbara, let's have a quick word on Juliet, who's played in this episode by an actress called Carlina Brich, I think. And I've seen a bit of debate about whether her character was like integral or not to this story. I mean, what it kind of reminded me of was you have the figure in Founder's Mutation of, I believe his name was Kyle Gilligan, who was also on like this kind of quest to reunite with his sister. what I thought was fascinating about her was like her zeal, you know, especially when it's like compared with the way like Scully observes her Faith in a much more low-key way, you know. What did you make of her?
One of the interesting things, and this ties back again, we're going to talk about Wong more specifically, I think, tomorrow, but like the three episodes that Wong has directed of the show all have this interesting sort of subtext where they feel like they're sort of modernizing the show, or the revival, in ways that are more overt than in, you know, other writers' episodes. Which is interesting because Wong is a veteran of the show rather than a new writer. And obviously this was written by Karen Nielsen, who was a new writer, but we'll talk about her script as well, maybe tomorrow as well. But one of the things about about Juliet that interests me is that she's very consciously stylized as the heroine of a CW show, in that she's introduced crouching on a rooftop, wearing a hood, with two sticks jutting out of her backpack, one of which turns out to be, it initially looks like a harpoon, it could be an arrow, it's later used as a stake, it turns out to be cut from the fence of the church. But it's very much in the style of like those superhero shows like, say, Arrow or Flash, which now populate the television landscape. And at one point Mulder even like makes this comparison between like superheroes and what Juliet's doing, you know, explicit, when he says, you know, Father Hardy said he was afraid that somebody might take the law into their own hands, become an Avenger. And you can practically hear Thanos in the background laughing at that point. But it does have that sort of like aesthetic. And I mean you could argue even that, like, the way in which Juliet's introduced, where she, like, you know, she jumps swinging down on the ropes, rolls on the ground, and impales a guy through the heart, is it maybe perhaps a nod to Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Because obviously this is a vampire episode in its own right. And Buffy the Vampire Slayer was a show that came along late in the original run of the X-Files, but which could in some way be seen as like a, you know, an antecedent or a forefather of the modern sort of superhero boom. Buffy was a superhero show that just didn't happen to use like comic book superheroes. And it happens like, and you could argue that there's a through line here, and you compared it to Founder's Mutation. I think you're right, and you can also see it with Ghoulie. They all have this sort of like CW superhero quality to them, where there are young kids who are given like these incredible powers, and sort of Mulder and Scully just sort of wander into the middle of what looks like it could be a pilot for like a modern sort of superhero show, like even say Legion, for example, or one of the Netflix Marvel shows or something like that. And I mean, there's an interesting point where Barbara asks if they found Netflix executive, but there is this sort of like playfulness to the character of Juliet, which I quite like. And I feel like that is like the show in some ways dealing with its age, or acknowledging its age, where like Mulder and Scully are obviously the embodiment of this 90s television institution, and Juliet is basically dealing with the same case but from the perspective of like a 2010s vigilante urban drama. And there's something sort of interesting in the contrast that exists between the two, I think.
Yeah, there really is. And in terms of the series, like, confronting its aging, I mean, we meet this cult, don't we? And it's this group, you know, they're all in thrall to this television star of years gone by, aren't they? And I mean, I don't know, have you got any ideas what 1013 could be driving at there?
I wonder. I've got no idea what they could possibly be hinting at. Well, I mean, it should be noted that there's something rather deliberate and cheeky in the casting of Fiona Vroom in the role of Barbara Beaumont, where, for example, she appeared quite... The show has recycled actors before. Obviously, it's used dozens of them, you know, over the years in different roles, because it's run for, you know, 11 seasons over 25 years at this point. But Fiona Vroom's first appearance on the show was in My Struggle Part 3, playing the wife of the cigarette-smoking man, while he was watching television broadcasting the moon landing that he had just faked. So you have this wonderful, like, you have this introduction of, like, you know, of Beaumont sitting on bed repeating lines from a television show that she filmed when Fiona Vroom had just been seen only, you know, 9 episodes earlier watching television on something that had simply been staged and rehearsed. And I wonder if there's a sense that the show is like, one of the big through lines in the 11th season has been this sort of like metafictional, like reality bending back on itself. And if there's something a bit playful in having Fiona Vroom then play an actor who is like repeating her own, sort of living through her own fantasy on television, like as a nod to her small cameo as, you know, the cigarette smoking man's wife earlier in the season. It's like a wonderful small little winking kind of self-referential thing, which is a little cheeky and a little playful, and I wouldn't put it past the writers and producers working on the show.
Yeah, well, like literally winking, wasn't she at the TV at one point, I think?
And yeah.
What about that sequence where she sings the song The Morning After, which I believe was a song originally written for the Poseidon Adventure, the 1970s film? What it reminded me of was, do you remember the Millennium episode, I think it was called Goodbye Charlie, with Tucker Smallwood as like a, he was like a euphonist or something.
Yes, he was. And he literally put people to sleep to the sound of his voice.
Yeah, but here in this episode, I thought it was a gripping scene, very uncomfortable to watch. And she pulled it off really well, that actress, I think.
Well, it's got that very Morgan and Wong, like I don't want to dismiss the, you know, this is Karen Nielsen's episode, she wrote it, but she's talked about how she was mentored by Morgan and Wong as she was writing it, and it has a very Morgan and Wong feel to it in certain respects, where it has, like, for example, the incorporation of a pop music standard in an ironic fashion, like Wonderful from Home, to pick one example, or Doesn't Somebody Want to Be Wanted from Never Again, to pick another example, where you get these wonderfully poppy, upbeat sort of like 60s, 70s songs, and then play them against these pictures of absolute horror and violence, and it works really, really well because you get that stunning juxtaposition between the two, and it plays remarkably well. Like, I mean, one of the things about Beaumont as a character, and it's really, really dark and it's really, really twisted, but it feels in some ways like the show is saying, what if Sharon Tate had actually led the Manson family? Because she's this actor who, and a lot of the films that Mulder cites, a lot of the appearances that he cites would have been in the 60s. So, for example, you know, she disappeared after, you know, the Beaumont show in 1967, for example. You know, she talks about, you know, her husband who disappeared around 1970. So she's definitely very much of that era. And I mean, you have obviously Duchovny, who appeared in Aquarius, which is a TV show where he hunted Charles Manson. You have the current interest in the Manson murders that's sort of permeating through pop culture. I mean, Margot Robbie has been cast as Tate in the new Tarantino film. But you have this sort of like cheeky sense almost of the show sort of winking at this idea of like a 70s or 60s or 70s actress who becomes the leader of this sort of cult, which is very clearly sort of like a twisted sort of family unit, which feels like very wry and very subversive and very dark. It's a really dark twist on the premise, which I admired in some ways, because it does feel very grindhouse horror movie exploitation-esque.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, she's such a weird figure, you know, she's like trying to stave off aging, you know, she's repeating the lines from her old shows like verbatim, you know, she's physically unchanged. And then, you know, she's juxtaposed with, you know, the middle-aged, although, as we've said, very well-preserved Mulder and Scully. And they're trying to work out where things go from here, what's the way forward. So I liked the sort of contrast between, like, the stasis of Barbara and the inching forward of Mulder and Scully, I guess.
Yeah, and her basically living in this room which she hasn't left. You know, she's got this little cult set up, and she's got these young fans who will, you know, sacrifice themselves to her and want to preserve her exactly as she was. And by the way, again, you're right when you say, what could the X-Files possibly be hinting at in this? It feels very much like, you know, in the Darren Morgan episode, The Lost Art of Forehead Sweat, where Scully has this conversation at the Jell-O, and she's like, I want to remember it as it was, all of it. And it feels almost like that, like, you know, Beauchamp is preserved exactly as she was, preserved in crystal, watching reruns of her old show and repeating the same lines, whereas Mulder and Scully have had this sort of, like, they've changed, they've grown, and they've evolved. And it feels almost like the show is, like, teasing this idea of, like, is it possible for the X-Files to be the same show in 2018 that it was in 1998, to pick an example? And, you know, obviously it's not, and to do that would be grotesque and horrible and, like, monstrous, and particularly to do that in a way that was exploitative, or a way that, like, you know, preyed upon fans by offering them something patronizing and condescending, and, you know, gave them, you know, in some ways, like, what they expect that they want, rather than, like, challenging them. Because, I mean, one of the things about, like, The X-Files is, like, The X-Files, when it appeared on television, why it attracted so many fans was because it was fresh and interesting and new and utterly, like, unlike anything else on television. So in some ways, to bring the show back and to make it exactly as it was would be a betrayal, I think, of the show on some fundamental level, perhaps.
Yeah, I think so too. And you used the word teasing, but I mean, you could use it in another context. You know, I've seen some fans take it that this episode was teasing the fans. And I mean, that hasn't been a widespread reaction, I don't think, but some people have taken it that way. And of course, we all remember episodes like Sunshine Days, where, you know, a lot of fans did take that episode to heart in a bad way, didn't they? You know, that the series was poking fun at their fans. So, I mean, how would you reflect on this episode in that regard?
I mean, I'm going to be honest. I think, like, Sunshine Days, like, I mean, was quite a, you know, a dark and cynical episode of television. I don't think it was particularly mean-spirited towards fans, because, I mean, you got to keep in mind that Vince Gilligan, you know, did this while building a Brady Bunch house that everybody, you know, that everybody and their children wanted to visit and take pictures in. So, I mean, you know, Gilligan is not one to cast stones in this sort of nostalgia sense. But even here, like, it's very clear that in the relationship that exists between Barbara and her cult-like followers, it's very clearly exploitative, like, by Barbara. The followers do nothing wrong. Like, the followers aren't even complicit in, say, the murder. At worst, they do deliveries and stuff like that. It's, you know, herself and her partner who are exploiting these people. So I feel like even if the show were making some comment on fandom, like, the show's doing that in a way that is designed to criticize, you know, the show that would exploit fans in such a way. You know, it's a criticism of, like, shows that are writers or creators who would pander in nostalgia, you know, who would trade in nostalgia. It's not a criticism of those who would, you know, accept nostalgia or who would love The X-Files so much. And being honest, I probably love The X-Files so much that they would, you know, accept it no matter what it did, and to exploit that or to take advantage of that. And I think that, like, the show is not a criticism of that fandom. It's a criticism of the exploitation of that fandom if it had taken place. It's more like, you know, the show hating the show that it could have been rather than picking on fans. Or at least that's how I would sort of read it.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I would agree on Sunshine Days as well. But I mean, even to this day, you talk to people who sort of took it the opposite way. Which is fair enough, I suppose. You mentioned her partner there. Let's have a quick word about him, because he was played by a guy called Jerry Burns. The character's name is Dr. Levinas. And, I mean, I think he's a very good actor, too. He's turned up in all sorts of stuff. He was in Breaking Bad briefly, I think, as the Narcotics Anonymous group leader. He'd been in series like Bates Motel, all sorts of things, really. And, yeah, I liked his performance, too.
He's great. He has a wonderful sort of presence. He has a wonderful sort of, like, he's here he's vaguely menacing, I think, like, even, but that's not his default setting. That's the actor that's doing what he's doing, and he does it very, very well. And, like, you gotta admit, like, the main focus of the episode is on Beaumont. So the fact that, like, you know, Loveness is fleshed out and feels like a real character of himself is a credit, I think, to Jer Burns, and a credit to the writing on the script as well. Like, the episode does spend a lot of time on the dynamic between Beaumont and Loveness as well, which I think is quite nice. Like, it's almost too parallel plot threads sort of running through. And, like, one of the things about the cult which is interesting, and I don't want to get the podcast gawkerized or anything like that. I know you know exactly what I'm going to talk about. But it's this idea of parabiosis, which is this wonderful... It's the core premise of the episode. And it's something that apparently came from Nielsen Consulting with Morgan as well. And there's something interesting in the metaphor at the heart of the episode, because it is basically, it's a vampire episode, right? The X-Files famously struggled when it tried to do, like, conventional monster narratives. Like, for example, 3 as a vampire narrative didn't really work, or Alpha as a werewolf narrative didn't really work, or even, say, the Jersey Devil as, like, a Bigfoot episode didn't really work. But the X-Files worked best when it sort of took a core idea and put a novel twist on it, like, say, the vampires in Bad Blood trying to reconnect with their roots, that sort of stuff. And, like, one of the things that I think this episode does very well is it takes the premise of a vampire and makes it new and interesting in a way that reflects modern culture. And, like, we talked about, like, I think yesterday, about how one of the things about season 11 is to embrace stuff like urban legends and creepypasta and stuff like that. This idea in the episode of, like, parabiosis, which is the idea of people literally taking blood from young people in order to feel youthful, it's something that is, you know, actually happening. It's something, like, there have been articles about people in Silicon Valley having this sort of, like, fad. I mean, there's an episode of Silicon Valley, which features, like, a joke about a young person who's dragged around as a literal blood bag. And, I mean, it's a wonderful metaphor that I think, to be honest, Nothing Lasts Forever sort of gets at this, of this metaphor of, like, capitalism as the embodiment of modern vampirism, where it's these old people who are literally draining the lifeblood out of children and taking advantage of them and setting up this system and this hierarchy that works. Like, I mean, at one point, Loveness describes the, you know, cult members as seeds that will grow into fruit. You know, these are literally just people to, they are objects to be exploited. They're not individuals or people. I mean, when Beaumont performs that wonderful sort of version of, you know, there has to be a morning after, the person who's listening to it gets gutted halfway through, like, the first verse. but there is this sort of, like, interesting, like, it's a really great vampire metaphor because it's a very modern and very relevant and very, like, it's a vampire metaphor that I don't think would have worked in the 90s. And it's very much in keeping, I think, with like other episodes of the revival that have done something similar, where they've taken an idea from the from the show's past and reworked it to reflect modern sensibilities. So, for example, the appearances of this man throughout the season, or the virtual reality in this, or followers' use of sort of like Black Mirror logic, or even like to Ghoulies' use of like the Slenderman mythos, for example. There's that sort of aspect of the episode and its villains, which I really, really like.
Yeah, and in terms of the exploitation of the cult members, one of the things that means is that when they're sort of called to action, they're, you know, they're fearsome opponents. So we get this climactic action, don't we? I mean, when we get beyond that, what did you make of... There's a really sad scene, I thought, where Olivia has been returned to her mother, but Juliet, of course, is in prison. So, I mean, I'm not sad for Juliet because she says, like, you know, this is my choice or whatever it was. But the mother, I feel particularly sad for at that moment.
One of the things I like about this, and this is when I talk about like the plot not really, you know, the plot beats not necessarily working. Like, I feel like Nothing Lasts Forever is one of those classic X-Files episodes where Mulder and Scully do very little to advance the plot. The most that they do to contribute to what actually happens of the plot is to put the tracker in the heart, which allows Juliet to find Barbara and to enact her brutal vengeance upon them. But like, one of the things that I like about it thematically is it touches on this idea of justice versus retribution, like because there's Juliet has this whole I will repay righteous avenger thing outside the law happening, but what happens is at the end, and Scully sort of talks about this when she in the final scene where she talks about like the, you know, all the effort that she puts into maintaining the status quo, like the episode ends in the exact same way that it begins, with like the family, the Bocanegra family, having one daughter who is taken away and inaccessible to them, and having another daughter at home. So in theory, nothing has been restored. Nothing has been gained from this horrible thing that has happened. It's just the daughters have switched places. You know, instead of having Juliet and Juliet at home and Olivia away, Olivia's at home and now Juliet is going to prison. And there's this like very clever narrative sort of choice of like having Juliet's, you know, Juliet's attempt to protect or to distribute justice really doing little to change her mother's position. Her mother is still heartbroken. Her mother is still missing a daughter at the end of the episode. I think that's a very clever touch.
Yeah, very clever. And I thought it was, even though it was very brief, it registered as a very poignant moment, I thought. Well, okay, Darren, we'll leave it there for today. And we'll return tomorrow to discuss the writer of this episode, first-time X-Files writer Karen Nielsen. And the episode's director, obviously an old hand as regards this series, James Wong. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter at @X_cast or on Facebook at X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group. We'll be back tomorrow, but until next time, trust no one.